This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. It's our Friday pitch-in. Coming up, Indiana had a record-high voter turnout, but so did the rest of the country. Has our civic engagement improved compared to the nation? We will hear from the co-founder of the Indiana Civic Education Foundation and find out what the relatively new organization plans to do now that the election's over. And later, this year's virtual Indie Jazz Fest will include original pieces inspired by the tumultuous year we've had. We'll hear from two of its organizers, who are also musicians, performing for the festival, which begins tonight. But first, we will start the way we always do on Friday with a look at the biggest Indiana stories of the week. Lauren Chapman is Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, and she joins us every week. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. But when we look at the numbers from the COVID-19 pandemic, it's been another big week. It's bad. I guess it's safe to say that. We had a day where we had over 6,000 new cases.
Yes, we did. As of noon today, 4,613 people have died from COVID-19, not including the probable deaths. Today, we reported 5,708 new COVID-19 cases, which is the second highest reported behind yesterday's 6,654.
Well over 6,000. Goodness gracious.
Yeah. So over the last week, ISDH has reported 307 new confirmed deaths, which is beyond our peak for deaths from late April. Previous to this week, we had never had more than 290. And that's paired with nearly 36,000 new positive COVID-19 cases in the last 7 days. Today's actually the first day, however, since October 31st, that our hospitalization rate has dropped. However, we're still at 2,548 Hoosiers who are hospitalized. Last week was the first time that we crossed 2,000 hospitalizations since ISDH began reporting that data. Indiana's 7-day average has increased by nearly 500% since the state moved to stage 5, which means we're at nearly 6 times the 7-day average from September 26th to now. And in that same time period, 65 counties have more than doubled their number of reported cases, with Fountain, Adams, and Warren counties having quadrupled their total number of cases since September 26th. And just going back to the color-coded map, which was when it was updated on Wednesday, only 5 counties were not designated orange or red. Basically just showing, again, really hammering home the idea that this is community spread.
Now, so many people are pointing to this being the second wave. What we know, though, is this is really kind of a third or fourth wave when we look at the curve.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to look at the curve now because of how exponentially our cases have grown.
So can we confidently say then that this so-called second wave is even bigger than the first back in the spring?
So the problem is that we can't compare cases numbers from March and April to now. We just didn't have the testing capacity. So that's the hard part of it, is that, you know, we do have the capability of testing thousands of people per day in the state of Indiana, which is why we're able to capture this kind of data. That all being said, when you look at things like hospitalization data or the number of deaths, these are two data points that you can point to and compare apples to apples between, you know, where we are in November and where we were in March and April. And the reality is that we're actually getting worse than we were even at our peak in March and April.
Mm. So the governor is acting. Can you tell us about the new restrictions?
Yes. Governor Eric Holcomb announced Wednesday he will impose some COVID-19 restrictions on counties failing to control the spread of COVID-19. These are fairly limited restrictions, but the new executive orders come after weeks of inaction in the face of worsening COVID-19 numbers. The state will use the color-coded COVID-19 map that we talked about, updates weekly to determine what restrictions counties face. It uses 7-day positivity rates and the number of weekly cases per 100,000 residents to assign a color to counties. These restrictions include event capacity limitations and social gathering limitations, but those restrictions don't appear to apply to businesses or schools. And local health departments can still approve events that exceed those gathering limits, including sporting events. Holcomb's latest round of COVID-19 restrictions, like many that came before it, also don't apply to houses of worship. But with these new restrictions, as well with all executive orders before, local governments can also impose tighter restrictions. So, for example, Monroe County attached fines to the governor's mask order, which has contributed to them keeping down their cases better than some smaller counties and, for that matter, their neighboring counties.
So when you look at this color-coded map, you can look at Monroe County, one of the most populous counties in the state, and it is not orange and it's not red.
No, it is orange.
Oh, it is orange. Okay.
Yeah,
last time I looked at the map, I guess it wasn't. But
yeah.
So they are doing better.
Yeah. I mean, even looking at just for like central Indiana, looking at Indianapolis compared to a lot of the donut counties, despite a higher population density, which would contribute to greater virus spread, Indianapolis has managed to maintain a slower spread of the virus, experiencing this surge at a slower rate than a lot of other counties because of the restrictions that Marion County Health Commissioner Dr. Virginia Kane, what she put in place in order to kind of keep things tapped down.
So this autonomy that the governor gives counties can also include counties giving the mask order a little bit of teeth, the way that Monroe County seems to have done.
Absolutely. It's also important to note that there is a problem that you run into with that kind of autonomy, right? That if you don't have restrictions that are going to have any sort of teeth, then you're going to run into greater problems, right? So, for example, yesterday evening in Johnson County, a person was kicked out of Mashcraft Brewery and came back threatening staff. They had to close down their business. Governor Holcomb said on Wednesday that he's encouraging businesses to do things like that by, you know, not letting people who are not wearing masks into businesses. But there are no consequences for that person's behavior until they start threatening people.
I was getting takeout last night and someone walked in without a mask and the staff shooed them out very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Places are taking this very, very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The Indiana Hospital Association is asking for some help. What are they doing? What's the problem?
Hospitalization rates are reaching their highest points ever, based on the data that we have of COVID patients. And the Indiana Hospital Association, or IHA, says healthcare workers face a lot of uncertainties as case numbers continue to surge. A spokesperson for IHA said Hoosier hospitals will continue to have to make difficult decisions when it comes to providing care if surging hospitalization rates don't improve and don't do so fast. One major concern is the number of staff that are worn out or overwhelmed or burned out. If these trends continue, the spokesperson said that hospitals will face staffing shortages, and it's something that we've heard from very specific places. I believe Delaware County has already experienced this a lot. I know that other counties across the state have. And the Indiana Hospital Association is saying that this could become a more global problem for Indiana.
Mm. So when you look at the data dashboard at coronavirus.in.gov?
Yes.
Is this alarm that they are sounding reflected in that data? I mean, are beds dwindling?
It's not necessarily so Indiana has a fairly deep bench for ventilators and for ICU beds. ICU beds had some issues previous. It's not a data point that I look at very frequently. ICU beds available right now are at 23.5%. I know that the state has the ability to, and hospital systems have the ability to kind of increase or decrease depending on where there is need. And especially with the I'm not going to remember the name. That's fine. They have the ability to increase or decrease that capacity. But the problem that we run into is that you still need staff. Like, even if you have beds, if you don't have, it's some of the problems that we're seeing in our schools right now, where, like, there aren't so many there aren't so many kids out that it's mandatory that a school shut down. But if you don't have teachers and then you don't have substitutes either, and you can't like provide enough educators for students, then that also becomes a problem. And that's kind of that sort of is a parallel thing that we're seeing in hospitals as well.
Personnel. Got it. Now, in somewhat positive COVID news, Lilly's antibody drug has been given authorization.
Yeah, it was given emergency authorization for its antibody drug. The Indianapolis-based company will be able to provide the treatment to mild to moderate COVID-19 patients who are 12 years or older and at high risk of it progressing to a more severe case and or hospitalization. And while the pharmaceutical company was actually conducting trials on the drug, it had actually worked to produce it as well. So with an expected 1 million doses of the antibody to be ready by the end of this year.
Okay. Let's take a look at a story out of Indianapolis. What did the grand jury for Drayshawn Reed find this week?
Yeah. Drayshawn Reed, for folks who may not be from Indianapolis or have not thought about this in a hot minute, Drayshawn Reed was a 21-year-old black man who was shot and killed by IMPD after a discontinued car chase. And the grand jury made a decision this week, announced that there was insufficient evidence to indict the IMPD officer du jour Mercer. After the special prosecutor spoke to reporters about the decision, Indiana State Police outlined the evidence they provided to her team to give to the grand jury. The evidence included a forensic review, camera footage, analysis of the shots fired, and evidence that Reed not only had a gun on his person, but had fired it at Officer Mercer. Part of this evidence also included audio of two shots being fired at once and actually being able to see two bullets crossing a trajectory based on the video that Drayshawn Reed had running as part of a Facebook Live. Mm-hmm. Local organizers demonstrated two of the last 3 days, calling for systemic changes, not only in the justice system, but also how local government works for black people and specifically people of color in Indianapolis.
It has been a big week in news, and I'm sure that will continue, that exact trend. Lauren Chapman is Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, and she brings it to us every week, good or bad. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, has Indiana's civic engagement improved? Indiana's voter turnout was at a record high, but plenty of Hoosiers still abstained from voting. Indiana Civic Education Foundation co-founder Bill Morrow breaks that down. What we know a week and a half after the election, we'll share next. I'm Matt Pelster. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelster. Voter turnout was high last week in Indiana, but that was part of a trend that was nationwide. The nonpartisan Indiana Citizen Education Foundation was founded last year with the goal of raising voter registration and participation in Indiana. Joining me now is co-founder Bill Morrow. Bill, good to have you back.
Good afternoon, Matt. Thanks for inviting me back.
So let's look at those numbers. What do we know for sure right now?
Well, you want the good news first or the bad news?
Well, let's keep it positive. Let's look at the good news first.
Okay, so good news. Indiana, we had a record turnout last Tuesday. Total turnout looks like it's going to exceed 3 million.
Wow.
For the first time. So that's really positive. But then when we start to get into comparisons, that's where the bad news comes in.
Well, but we still had record turnout. That's a win, right?
Yippee. So did the rest of the country, right? Yeah. So this is going to feel a lot like 2018 for Hoosiers, where we came out of 2018 really excited that we had a record turnout for midterms, and only to discover, well, so did the rest of the country. So Despite our record turnout, we are going to continue being mired in the bottom 10 of states for turnout.
Really? You think we're still in the bottom 10 even after all this?
Yes. So final numbers are not in. So I'm relying on several different sources, particularly University of Florida professor who really tries to get updated information as quickly as possible, right? So everything I say is subject to the final certified results from the 50 states and the District of Columbia. But based upon what I've seen, yes, we're going to still be stuck in the bottom 10.
Okay. Well, but what about the official data from like the Indiana Secretary of State's website? I mean, how much of that is certified, posted up? How much of that could we crunch, I guess?
Well, right. So this is as of Thursday around noon. Two-thirds of the precincts in the state had actually reported their numbers into the Secretary of State's office. So this doesn't include Allen County, Hamilton, Lake, Marion County, St. Joseph County, Vanderburgh County. So the biggest counties have not yet filed their official results with the Secretary of State's office. So at the moment, that's not the best source of information, only because the Secretary of State has to rely on the counties reporting their results. So for those of us who follow the Purdue IU competition, Tippecanoe County, home of Harvard and the Middle West, Purdue University, and Monroe County, home of the other state school, they do have the other, they do have the results in. And so for Purdue fans, turnout in Tippecanoe County exceeded Monroe County, but the turnout rate in Monroe County was higher.
Okay. So, I mean, do you know what we can attribute that delay to with respect to the other counties? I mean, with the other counties, is it a delay?
Well, look, the county clerks are not going to want to report their data into the Secretary of State's office until it gets to a 100% degree of accuracy.
Okay.
You can go on the Marion County Election Board site and get some Marion County numbers, right? And it does show that turnout in Marion County in 2020 exceeded 2016, but only by about 6%. So here again, when those of us who live in Indianapolis were looking at absentee voting, in-person absentee voting, meaning early voting, and election day voting, we thought, boy, we're headed for a record turnout. Well, we are going to have a record turnout in Marion County, but only about a 6% increase from 2016 figures.
Gotcha. Now, let's talk about factors that could have, I guess, pushed us at least out of the bottom 10 and maybe more into the middle of states, if not to the top 10. How about the decision to allow no excuse absentee voting in the primary, but then not for the general election? Does it seem like that was much of a factor? We still had high turnout.
Well, so this, correct. So this is about speculating about the impact of a policy that was not enacted, right? So you have to look back to the primary and see what effect it had on the primary.
Sure.
And in fact, for historical purposes, the delayed 2020 primary performed at about the same level, the turnout, as prior years in which there was not a contest at the presidential level, if you're following me. Mm-hmm. So, so we think that the turnout in the primary would have been far lower than it would have been without the decision, the correct decision that we lauded and supported and wrote letters in support of, without the decision to go to no excuse absentee voting in the delayed primary. So the natural corollary to that is that had no excuse absentee voting been permitted in November, the turnout would have been higher.
Well, let's take the pandemic out of the equation. I mean, Am I correct in assuming that you are in favor of no excuse absentee voting, regardless, 100%, the way who does it that way? Utah, Colorado, California.
No. All but five states. When it came to
But that's pandemic related, right? I mean,
some of it was pandemic related. Well, so as it was in our primary. Right. I mean, so pandemic related or not pandemic related as the motivator of the public policy choice, the same decision makers who made the decision in the spring in Indiana to go to no excuse absentee voting in the primary made a different decision as it related to the general election because they declared the general election would be a normal election, notwithstanding all the data that was out there regarding the pandemic. So, yeah, we are really disappointed that the decision was made to call this a normal election because these are not normal times. And we think, and this is, I will admit to speculation, but this we think probably knocked a couple hundred thousand votes out of the general election turnout, and that's just disappointing. Disappointing. In fact, I may go on.
Sure.
This is a moment in which shouldn't the presumptions, right? Shouldn't the presumptions be in favor of policies that support increased turnout, right? So, meaning that those same decision makers should have said, this really worked for the primary. And unless we think it's going to have a suppressing effect, right? Unless we think it's going to drive down turnout, let's go ahead and do it in the fall. But the opposite conclusion was reached.
We're talking with Indiana Citizen Education Foundation co-founder Bill Morrow. So let me come back to that original question. Then, are you as the co-founder of the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation in favor of no excuse absentee voting, regardless of pandemic, would you like to see that in Indiana as it is in a lot of other states, a few other states?
Yes. So, Matt, when you think about the policy choices that tend to encourage people to vote and you look around the states and you look at especially in the top 10 of states, top 20 of states, and the policies that they have implemented, no excuse absentee voting is as close to a no-brainer as you will find in this area.
What about these accusations of it being rife with voter fraud that we've heard? I mean, we know that some of them are baseless, but I don't know how baseless are they, I suppose.
I'm sorry, you've caught me off guard. Is there a single allegation, right? Can anybody in this state hold up one finger and say there's evidence of voter fraud in Indiana?
It's difficult to find. It's difficult to find if there is any.
Difficult to find? It's impossible to find, buddy. Impossible to find.
Well, okay, so let's look at the good news, the high turnout. I mean, we may not be out of the bottom 10, but we still had high turnout, and a lot of that comes down to what was on the ballot and the strong feelings about the candidates. And obviously a presidential race drove a lot of people to the polls, but what were some of those other races that contributed to Indiana's high turnout?
Well, you're asking me to stipulate to Indiana's high turnout. Okay, right? This is that
you
moment,
are a
right?
lawyer, aren't you? You
well,
are a lawyer.
But look, this is what's so great about this conversation is because we did have record turnout, some of our supporters called me and said, Bill, declare victory.
We did it.
Come on.
You don't think so?
Well, there's this theory, this management theory, I guess, that if you're going to, you're going to get blamed for things you didn't do, you might as well take credit for things you didn't do. But I'm not in that school, right? It would be disingenuous for anybody to be proud of our record turnout, right? Note that it's the record, but you got to then go to the next step and say, it could have even been better than that.
Mm. So do you think that the governor's race had anything to do with it, or do you think that it was all presidential that drove the record turnout?
I'm not smart enough to figure that out. All right. But there was virtually no contested election for governor. Right. Whether that was a deterrence on people actually showing up. Right. And now I'm going to get down to the weeds a bit. But the turnout number that Secretary of State's report is always higher than the total number of votes cast in any statewide race. Okay, let me pause there, right? Think of the first number, the total votes cast, as the number of people through the turnstiles on election day,
sure,
which, of course, includes absentee and early voting. But, you know, everybody, many voters make the conscious decision that since none of the above is not on the ballot, they simply don't vote in one of the races, right? A classic example is 2016, in which the total turnout in Indiana was actually 50,000 greater than the total votes cast for president, right? So voters go in and they make their choices, and sometimes the choice is not to vote at all in that particular race.
Huh, interesting. Wow, how very interesting. I did not know that. That is a fascinating statistic. So can you tell me what's next for the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation? Presidential elections behind us, not much on the ballots next year. What are your plans, I guess, between now and the midterm?
Well, right. So we think we have made a contribution toward this turnout. We think we made a contribution toward informing voters, the information platform that our digital content director, soon to be named editor-in-chief, Kevin Morgan, made toward these profiles with the information, unbiased information, right? We're going to continue on into 2021 and build those out, sort of a directory, if you will, of elected officials in the state of Indiana. And we've been in some conversations with potential partners about playing a role in coverage of the news that's going on in the Indiana State House.
Oh.
So, yeah, so that's how we think of 2021 going into 2022. And yes, so 2022, if we're still around and we have the funding in place, hint, hint, then we'll, dust off our registration, education, and turnout campaign again in 2022.
So covering the State House. I mean, we have a State House reporter. He's very good, Brandon Smith. There are one of the best
in the State House.
I couldn't agree more. But do you think that there is a hole to fill there, covering the State House?
Well, I hope Brandon would agree with this, right? Because he can't cover everything that's going on in the
sure.
State House. But you know, gosh, when I was in the State House in the late 80s and early 90s, those press checks down on the first floor were filled to overflowing. I think the number there were like 30 reporters who were accredited to cover the General Assembly when it was in session. I mean, that number's now got to be under 10. So, yeah, this is something that comes up time and time and time again when you talk to those who have an interest in what's going on in the State House is just how much coverage has just dropped off just because there's simply not enough journalists over there to cover all the news that's created.
Now, I'm sure that the influence might be indirect, but correct me if I'm wrong. But do you think that more coverage of the State House would influence voter turnout?
Yes, but also associated with that is coverage of the policy choices, these pro-democracy policy choices that need to be made in the 2021 session of the General Assembly. For example, redistricting, also known as gerrymandering, right?
Sure.
Redistricting will take place in 2021, and the way those maps are drawn has an effect on turnout. So that so coverage of that issue would be front and center for what we're doing, and no excuse absentee voting. You know that is probably one of the simplest legislative changes that could be made is to enact no excuse absentee voting. Right? Let's follow that issue. So they're a bundle of these pro-democracy policy choices that could be made in the 2021 session that would be right in the Indiana citizens' wheelhouse to cover.
We got just about a minute left, so I'm going to ask a broad question. You can choose to answer it however you want. You are the co-founder of the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation. So I guess that broad question would be, what do Hoosiers need to learn about responsible citizenry? What work do you have yet to do?
Well, I want to give a plug here for the great work that has been done this year by the Indiana Civic Education Task Force, under the leadership of Lieutenant Governor Crouch, with support from the Indiana Bar Foundation. They're about to release their final report, and I urge all Hoosiers who care about this issue to read that report and support its recommendations.
Last year's report brought you and I together, and it is readable. It's not one of those government reports.
No, these are two different things. I want to clarify. So us together was the Indiana Civic Health Index. The Indiana Civic Health Index, which is published in odd numbered years, made two recommendations. Recommendation number one, appropriately, was to work on civic literacy and civic education.
Gotcha.
And that resulted in this task force, whose results are going to be reported soon. Recommendation number two was to try to get out of the bottom 10 of states and get into the top 10 of states for turnout. And we didn't come anywhere close to that.
Well, there's always the midterm. You got 2 years to work on it. Bill Morrow is co-founder of the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation. Bill, thanks.
Thank you, Matt.
Up next, this year's Indie Jazz Fest starts tonight, and it's all virtual, of course. I talked to a couple of the organizers and musicians next about how they did it and what to expect. And we'll hear a little music as well. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Like so many other things, the Indie Jazz Fest has gone virtual for this year. But rather than scramble to roughly adapt this annual event to be online only, the organizers have totally revamped the festival for an online audience and incorporated original, locally inspired music. Here to talk with us are two of the organizers and musicians, Rob Dixon. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing, Matt? Thanks for having me on.
Doing okay. You're the artistic director of the Indie Jazz Fest, and we also have with us Charlie Ballantyne. Good afternoon, Charlie.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
So, Rob, I just want to get an idea of what a normal year is like, I guess. Were it not for the pandemic, what would the Indie Jazz Fest be like this year?
Oh, well, normally, it happens over a course of 10 days in September, and usually we start planning a year out. We'll have a blend of national artists or international artists, and then artists that are based here in Indianapolis, as well as regional artists. And then we just try to compile a program over 10 days of all those artists. Of course, now that we exist in this post COVID-19 environment, that was not even remotely possible. So we had to pivot and think of a way we could do pull off the Indie Jazz Fest. So,
I mean, as you saw things changing this year, I mean, you had this new list of challenges, not the least of which being that you are yourself a musician and you had to watch your own bottom line. How did the execution of the Indie Jazz Fest evolve over the year before the decision in August was made to go all virtual?
Well, that is actually a really good word to use, evolve, because it was in a constant state of flux because, you know, everything was changing constantly. The more people were infected by COVID, the more restrictions we had. We actually started out saying, okay, we're going to do the festival because we thought that the pandemic wouldn't last over the summer and be gone. And so we were trying to plan accordingly. And then we said, well, what if we did only a hybrid festival? Just a few in-person things. It just kind of went from one stage. And then we just, you know, in August, we were like, there's no way that we could do anything with the in-person event. So we decided to go all virtual. And we thought it was a good decision then. And it turns out it was a great decision because things didn't get better, actually, you know, as far as the amount of people that have been infected. So we were happy with the decision to go all virtual.
So what are you going to do this year? What's it going to look like, I guess, in a nutshell?
So the festival is in four parts, and what we've done is we've commissioned three artists, three musicians in town, and one was Jared Thompson and his band Premium Blend. The other was the group Native Son, which is a great hip-hop group that infuses jazz. And then Charlie Ballantyne was one as well. And they all wrote original pieces based on something based on Indianapolis or something that they experienced in 2020. That was kind of the subject matter. It was kind of, you know, up to them what they wanted to do. But yeah, and we say, hey, look, can you expand on the work that you do, on the originals you do? Come up with something that you can add on. Charlie added a string section onto his works, and also poetry, or readings, a narration, as well as a music box, toy box. And Native Son added on an 8-piece string section, and Jared Thompson and his Premium Blends band expanded their ensemble as well. And we filmed all these things in partnership with actually WFYI, who filmed all of them in different locations. And what we came up with is really creative. And some of the works that, well, all of the commissions are of the highest artistic merit that I've seen in a long time. The fourth part, which was the intro, is an event we call Celebrate Naptown, and we were able to partner again with WFYI and Indy Parks to record all the musicians doing a piece at Garfield Park. And this was like mid-September, like I think around September 19th when we did this. And we had no audience present. There were a few board members that came out to watch the video production of it. But yeah, and so we're going to air all these things that we've recorded over the next couple of weekends.
Charlie Ballantyne, let's talk about your commission for this project. I mean, the inspiration was Kurt Vonnegut. How do you turn the tone of his work into jazz compositions?
I kind of approached it, you know, as I was reading these novels. I had these sort of scenes in my head, and the way I approached it was essentially like scoring a movie. You know, I have these scenes, these characters in my head, so I wanted to kind of create some sort of thematic material that I felt like represented the feeling I got from these situations and characters in the novels. So yeah, I tried to make it as cinematic and as visual as possible, just to try and bring some of this writing to life.
I understand you got some cooperation and collaboration from the Vonnegut Museum as well. How were they involved?
Yeah, it was great working with everybody over there. They were involved in a few different ways. We met with them originally just to present the idea and see if they wanted to get on board in any way they wanted and saw fit. And they were very gracious with their support. And they actually, you know, the cover, the asterisk, which is a Vonnegut symbol, universal symbol of his, I was going to use for the cover, and it was actually copywritten. Which I didn't know about. So they kind of helped us get around that. And then the curator, Chris Lefebvre, read some segments on the WFYI recording that we did, the live recording with the string section. He was the one reading the excerpts out of the books for the live performance. So they were really great to work with. And anything we asked for, they were very responsive and supportive on the whole project.
Rob, you're featured in Charlie's band for this commission. What'd you think of it?
You know, I thought it was fantastic. And actually, when he asked me to do it, it was before I asked him to actually perform at Indie Jazz Fest. He actually had the idea before I asked him about it. And when I heard the music and I went into the studio and started recording, I just went up to him immediately. I said, we have to present this at Indie Jazz Fest. This is fantastic. It just celebrates the legacy of jazz in Indianapolis and celebrates the legacy of, you know, literary works that were by Indianapolis native. It was very Indianapolis-centric, and I loved it. So I thought it would just be the perfect project to present at Indy Jazz Fest. And then COVID happened, and then it was like, okay, well, we definitely have to do this.
Well, I mean, Charlie, I guess this music's been around for a little while. You've been working on it for a while, but you added some additional parts, which gave it some new life when it came time to recording it for Indie Jazz Fest. What did you put to it?
I decided to add a string section. It was already a pretty big band. We had six or seven people on each song. And it was, you know, Mina Cohane, the piano player on the record, arranged everything for me. She's a great composer and arranger in town and, you know, kind of helped me out with that. I wrote the music, but I didn't know where I wanted each part to go. And I had, you know, some uncertainty there. So when it came time to put these string players on it and create these arrangements, she stepped up and just did an incredible job creating new textures on this music. And that makes it fun for me too, because even though I wrote the music and spent a lot of time with it, I get to hear it in a new light when I'm performing it. It's just like, wow, this is, you know, like hearing my music for the first time. It's a cool thing.
Did that seem to like hybridize the music? Did it seem to like blur the jazz genre line a little bit, or did it still really feel like jazz?
I don't know if it ever felt like jazz, really.
No.
The compositions, you know, are there's a couple tunes that swing and stuff, but it, you know, it was it didn't feel like it. For the first time when I was composing this music, I wasn't basing it off of my musical influences. Like, you know, sometimes when I'm writing a tune, it's like, oh, this kind of sounds like a Wes Montgomery or a Pat Metheny thing, and I didn't have any musical influence in mind. It was all based off of the literature. So it kind of rendered some interesting results that, yeah, I think it always kind of blurred the lines of genres.
You brought one of these pieces for us to hear today. What is it?
The piece I brought is the first one on the record. And I think the first one we performed in the WFYI recording for Jazz Fest. It's a song called Sympathy for Malachi Constant.
You're going to deliver your message after all, said Constant. Anybody who has traveled this far on a fool's errand, said Salo, has no choice but to uphold the honor of fools by completing the errand. My mate died today, said Constant. Sorry, said Salo. I would say, is there anything I can do? But Skip once told me that that was the most hateful and stupid expression in the English language. Constant rubbed his hands together. The only company he had left on Titan was whatever company his right hand could be for his left. I miss her, he said. You finally fell in love, I see, said Salo. Only an Earthling year ago, said Constant. It took us that long to realize that a purpose of human life, no matter who is controlling it, is to love whoever is around to be loved.
Wasn't the hope for this year to headline the Indie Jazz Fest by premiering these Vonnegut-inspired pieces? What would have been, I guess, your ideal way to do that?
Yeah, it would have been, you know, great to be in person. You know, I miss that now more than ever, to have a big audience in front of us, whether it was outdoor at the cabaret or at the Madam Walker. But at the same time, you know, I'm super grateful for whatever format we're able to put together at this point, and for Indie Jazz Fest to be working so hard to create this virtual experience at this moment in time, in this context, it is ideal. You know, I couldn't imagine a better way to present in this climate.
Do you, given the collaboration with the Vonnegut Museum, are there any talks of, you know, once we're out of this, I don't know, doing a performance there on their nice big outdoor patio of some of these pieces?
Yeah, we've definitely talked about, you know, kind of a ticketed event over there that would be a lot of fun to kind of have a almost like a post-release release at this point, a post-COVID release or something. But yeah, we're, you know, with the winter and flu season being pretty uncertain at this point, we're it's all just kind of talking about things and hoping that, you know, the other side of this is sooner than later.
Rob Dixon, about, I don't know, about how long are these virtual concerts going to be? What's the commitment for people when they're logging in at their homes, either on their computers or on their TVs? What are we talking here?
It's definitely under an hour. So we're looking
really?
At about about 45 to 50 minutes. And it's not all of the material that's going to be released on these things. You know, there'll be, it'll be about, so like I would say about just under an hour for everyone. But what we had in mind too, and this addresses your last question, as far as this commission, and I've told the artist, this is kind of like something that is going to be ongoing. So not only is this going to be this performance and this recorded performance, but into 2021, we want to have them, if things, you know, restrictions are let up or we can do things more in other places, we want to have those performances, feature their performances in different venues, maybe the public library, maybe at a park. We want to see this thing so everybody gets the chance to experience the great work and the artistic statements by these musicians.
How much is it to log in and watch?
So it is absolutely free.
Oh.
So, which is great. So I encourage everyone to check it out because there's no ticket fee. There's no cost.
But money is being raised through the Indie Jazz Fest, though. How is that?
Yeah, so we've raised money just by, we've asked a lot of our patrons that have given in the years past to give money to help us with this, as well as, you know, there have been some wonderful grants by the Arts Council of Indianapolis that have helped us, Indiana Arts Commission and Whitehall Clues, Lilly Endowment. You know, there are a lot of organizations, the CICF, that are helping out with artistic endeavors for the arts organizations. And we're trying to take advantage of their help because we definitely need it because ticket revenue is not something that just doesn't exist for us this year.
Rob, where else can we hear you on this virtual event? Did you perform with any of the other ensembles?
I did. So I performed on two songs with, I think maybe two songs with the Native Son group and also on the Garfield Park sessions. I think we're calling it Celebrate Naptown. I performed maybe three times and I actually have my band featured on one of those songs in the Garfield Park sessions to Celebrate Naptown.
Charlie, I imagine that the environment, the space, is an important element in a jazz performance, not the least of which, of course, being the presence of the audience. How did these performances feel different?
It was it's an interesting thing. You know, it's not as much the space that is a factor for me, but it's channeling that energy of pretending there are 200 people in front of you, you know, for a jazz performance. And I think we did that, you know, it helps having the string section and all these great musicians around you. And yeah, but that's through the last 6 months, that's been like all the live streams, all the things we've done. It's so hard to capture that energy of the live audience. I don't think any of us realized how big of a factor that is. So as much as the audiences miss the music, we miss the audiences.
Charlie Ballantyne is performing a week from tonight in the Indie Jazz Fest with a series of pieces entitled Vonnegut. Charlie, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Matt. This was fun.
And Rob Dixon is the artistic director of the Indie Jazz Fest, which kicks off tonight at IndieJazzFest.net. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.